Hello and welcome once again to Indiepocalypse Radio, the number one Indiepocalypse radio on the internet on Saturdays from 2 to 4 Eastern time. That is the Indiepocalypse. I don't know what's going on. Everyone's getting a little. The word Indiepocalypse is coming up a lot lately. So there must be somebody out there who pulled up a Steam chart again. And it's like, look how many games are getting released every week, and everyone's going, oh, it's the Indiepocalypse. I'm like, the idea is impossible. There is always been too much art. There exists, before the invention of video games, too much art for one person to experience within their lifetime. Before Steam, there existed too many video games, likely, for one person to experience in their lifetime. Anyway, speaking of there being no such thing as too many games in the world, we've got a person who made games, coincidentally enough. It's kind of like it's the theme of the show. Oh, right, I'm Andrew, I make Indiepocalypse, and then as a result of it being a one-staff operation, I also host, you know, the state radio, I guess, of Indiepocalypse. Anyway, we're here with our first and only, I think we're rounding out our solo sesh shows as I catch back up with people actually saying yes to the show. I don't expect everyone to say, hey, yeah, I've made a game that I submit to your thing. I would love to then be interviewed live on the internet and then have my voice recorded for all time forever, and then have to live with, do I have to say everything perfectly? Am I a public speaker? Anyway, the point is, we're here with a guest who you may know from issue 36 of Indiepocalypse with labor rights funeral in Ukraine. It's Valeri. Hello, how are you doing today?
Hello, I'm doing fine.
Perfect. That's the perfect amount of way for somebody to be doing. So that as it warrants no further questions. The person who is asking how are you doing is the result they are looking for.
Yep. It's always a difficult question to answer. How do I answer it? Like, how do I answer it in a way that is polite and, you know, probably the way that person who asks me wants me to answer, or do I answer honestly and just spill it out?
The answer is never honestly. The answer is always, how are you doing, is an extension of our pleasant conversation. It's the kind of way of saying, I'm saying hello to you, but I'd like to speak to you further. Mm-hmm. Is how I look at it, perhaps. But speaking of looking at it, how did you first look at Indiepocalypse, which is to say, how did you find this thing?
Well, it has kind of found me, I guess, because, it's a long story. My partner, she develops games occasionally too, and she was actually in one of the earlier issues of Indiepocalypse. It was issue 34 or 35. Her game was called What's Up in Kharkiv Bomb Shelter.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
If you were privy to the pre-show, that was the game I was going to refer to, as in the game that was found through Indiepocalypse and was in, like, Guardian or some other article.
Yeah. She made a game way back in the beginning of 2022, when the war in Ukraine sort of escalated and got us where we are today. And I think she found your game jam on itch.io, and she submitted game there, and you took her in, and this is how I knew about Indie Apocalypse. And then I looked at it, and I thought that it's a very neat and interesting sort of idea to bundle a bunch of if the indie games is a correct term, because it's kind of loaded a bit today, but games from different authors this sort of approach to curating this sea of games, as you've mentioned in the introduction. I thought that it's very interesting idea, and I decided to submit my game, and here we are.
Yeah, I have found, I go through a lot of different words to finding what you would call it. Right now I refer to them as alternative games, but there's no good word to describe this kind of, you know, bedroom development style, besides maybe bedroom development, you know.
There's a term, I'm not sure if this is how it is called in English, but a people's art, right?
Yeah.
So it's like folklore, folk traditions, art that is it's not that exactly, but it's kind of similar, because
yes,
it's sort of more less I don't know, less big names, you know, more about many different people creating many different things and sharing them.
Yeah, I have stumbled across multiple kind of that the phrase doesn't exist cleanly in English, that the at least the one that I'm looking for to describe what it is, like this space between hobby and professionalism, and this kind of this is for myself but also for other people, and for you know, the difficulty of navigating what is art that is clearly does not look the same as business-minded art, but is not also is also, you know, made seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And there's at least it, you know, in English, hobby, which is I think a good word for it, it has also a very kind of frivolous connotation to it, where it's kind of you do stuff as a hobby. A hobby is something that you don't take serious, that you do for fun.
Yes.
even though hobbies are quite serious.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think hobbyism is a very I don't know. I mean, the term hobby is very loaded too, but I think it's kind of close to the idea. I mean, we have this term in Ukrainian and in Russian. It's called samodeitelnost. I'm not sure how to translate it in English. I'll try Google, essentially, it's amateur performance, right? When people that have regular jobs, and they from all sorts of professions, and they sort of gather in this club in the evenings, and they just perform to their pleasure some form of art, be it music or theater or something else. And I feel games that you're talking about are something like this, because they're not all from people who are making games professionally.
Yes.
That's kind of essential.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I would hazard that maybe like of the, you know, some almost 400 people who have made games for Indiepocalypse so far, I would say probably a handful of them make games professionally, like, you know, mm-hmm. unless people are keeping secrets. But I don't think a lot of them are like, maybe there are some software developers, but I don't think a lot of them are, you know. I mean, I myself do not make video games for a living or work even like adjacent to video games. I work in like manufacturing in the office, of course, because I'm not skilled enough to have a trade in that kind of way. Though, like, it'd be nice to have, like, I think about, like, what if I just got a trade and I just left all this behind and I kind of could do stuff with my hands.
Yeah.
That didn't involve a computer. But
that would have been nice.
Yeah, I save that for, like, odd jobs when I want to do something and build something quick off to the side. Like, oh, I can build a little piece of something. And then I almost got into, like, model making as kind of like, oh, those seem like they could be fun if they're cheap enough. But there is like a, as like you said, there is it is very much like, even though it's online, it does have like the feeling of people coming together after their job to make things like largely like for the sake of making things.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm definitely one of those handful of people who are actually game developers, because this is my main job. So I make games like as my regular job, but then in the evening when I'm free, I sit and make more games.
Yes, but games our adventure are very different.
Yes, but I mean the sorts of processes and like techniques that I use are so different that you can almost say that I that's something very different, like some very different kinds of jobs.
Yeah.
Because I work in a big sort of mobile game making company, and it's a huge enterprise, like a couple thousand people probably all around the world, and it's very like hierarchical and bureaucratic, and I sort of I work in design, and I do some very specific like tasks that have some very specific technical you know requirements, and it feels sort of as a conveyor, like as a as a factory in some way.
Right, because you are seeing a very small part of the game that is getting made.
Or I'm like, in my case, it's more like I see a game in a very broad strokes.
Yeah,
and I never actually approach any kind of, you know, practical parts of its realization. So I'm not like programming, I'm not you know, drawing, I'm not an artist. I am not a technical designer who combines like all the parts together. I'm only like overseeing the more, you know, more general sort of vision. And basically, what I'm joking that most of my time I'm just telling other people what to do.
Right.
And which not yeah.
I've learned before in like a global game jam is also when you have a billion people, turns out to be a very essential job as well.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. It's essential if you have such big operation. But it was never the kind of way I wanted to make games when I came into game making.
Right.
I mean, and I think that's the problem with big game making. One of the problems, obviously, there are many of them, but one of them is that sort of if you're in game design, you at some point you're gonna be so abstracted from the work, and the more like the more skilled you became, the more experience you gain, you were sort of ascend higher and higher, and at some point you're like some sort of producer, and you're not even touch the game or touch it in like once a year, and all you do is just you know, say some directions to the people, and they interpret them. Yeah. And then other people interpret their interpretations, and then like down below this chain, there's someone who actually makes the stuff. Yeah, and it's kind of for me, you know, it's not very fulfilling in terms of I want something that maybe is much smaller
right.
in scale, but much more like personal and. Actually made by me.
Yeah, something you get yeah. like all your hands on, you know. So it's
yes,
like
yes,
it's like you got very into woodworking, and then you found yourself shuttled off to an office far away from everything else, just simply looking at diagrams of tables, and you're like, wait a minute, I wanted to make these. How did I end up here?
Yeah,
but there's still like a satisfaction to it. But also, it's like, hey, what if? And I think that's the benefit of like a small scale, like development and like low resource engines and all that stuff, is that you can, after a long day of making games, go home and then make more games.
Yeah, I mean, I had a friend who had like you know, she was making plans on her. It was a couple years ago, and she was making plans on her next year, and she. Like said that she wanted to have a hobby that is not connected to games.
Yeah.
Essentially, I'm basically all my time is games, almost all of them.
Yes,
yeah,
so
and other people, but yeah. And I'm like, but I don't think that I am tired of it.
Yeah.
Maybe because exactly because I have this sort of outlet in making my games, and
yeah.
I can express myself to them.
And you're making two like very different kinds, so it's not like you're spending all day programming in Unity and then going home and programming in Unity some more. You know, it's two different kind of spectrum. And speaking of game, let's actually talk about this game that you made.
Yep.
Tell me what is Labor Rights Funeral in Ukraine?
Well, first of all, Labor Rights Funeral in Ukraine is a game made in Bitsy. Bitsy is a small game engine made for making small games and small worlds. It was created by Adam Ledoux. I think I should highlight this because the way my game look and feels plays is... owes very much to the medium it was built in. So Bitsy is very, very, very restrictive in
yes.
the way what kind of games you can produce. But also it's very. It kind of simplifies a lot of things, makes. It makes making games relaxing for me, for lack
yeah.
of a better word. Because when I sit in Unity, it's has much more possibilities, but it's very sometimes very intimidating and
right.
like daunting.
Because to get to those possibilities, you have to do a lot
yeah.
of work to get there.
Yeah. It has a lot of subsystems and like very. Complex things you can do, and it's how should I put it? It's like it's easy to make bad game in Unity because you lack some skills in specific area,
right.
Or you just don't know how to program a scene, or you don't know how to make a good animation in Photoshop or something like this. And in Bitsy, you can do much less in terms of types of games, but the game you do, they all look kind of complete.
Yes.
You know, they have, say, a specific style and vision, and it helps a lot. And then I even used to, like, I always recommend Bitsy to people who start making games, to just you know, sit and make a game or a few games in several hours, and just you know, just experience this process in this sort of small scale. So yeah, I just wanted to say that it's a very very important that Bitsy exists, because it's because of Bitsy that I'm making games right now. Probably if I had no such handy tool, it would be much longer, and I would have dropped much more projects than I do.
Right, right. If you had to like worry about like, well, how do I make a guy move in the first place? Never mind.
Yes.
Move well, and then how do you make text boxes and all this? Like it gets the work done that you want to get done, so it lets you focus on design.
Yes, exactly. Like, and it's also very simple in terms of usability, and you can do much of this in. You can do all of the work you need in browser, and it's very intuitive. And sometimes I just turn on a podcast or some audiobook, and I just listen to it and make a game at the same time, which is probably not the thing that is going to happen when I work in Unity.
No. Because,
yeah, it requires much more, you know, attention.
But
so yeah. Yeah.
And no. And so no, I was agreeing.
Yeah. So Bitsy is also one of the reasons why we. By me, I mean me and my partner were, you know, making games this particular year, because when the war started, we basically, like, how the game that my partner did was created. She, we were like for several days in a bomb shelter, and. But we had like electricity and internet connection, so we decided that we should make games about the situation we're in. And Bitsy was, you know, simple enough, and the process was so quick, so we can make it in like in a week or several days. So and then I just got to it, and I saw it as a way of making like games that are more simple in their sort of, you know, in their realization, but you're more direct and more like political in the way what they are talking about.
Right, because they allow you to make a game more quickly. So when you are feeling something, it's not like I'm feeling I want to express something. It's not like, well, it'll be done in 6 months. You can do it in a weekend.
Yeah. And my last game I actually made exactly in a weekend, and it was a game about blackouts in Ukraine that was caused by the bombardments. So I mean, it took me only 2 or 3 days, and it was very nice to, you know, just feel something strongly about this situation, and then just doing it and releasing it in this world.
Yeah, it allows you to get closer to this kind of like diary entry, or like a diary comic, or more like just like a song, something else that can be made very, like, you know, not like a full production. Doesn't need to be a full production, but it can be made very quickly because the elements of it are small.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Something where the length of the game doesn't feel outstretched by like the length of time it took to develop it.
Yeah. I mean, I still like somehow managed to make some of my BC projects so large that I stopped developing them. But yes. it's kind of a habit as a game developer.
How many unfinished 300-page novels are lying around out there, you know?
Yes. Like some ambitions creep in when you start doing it, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and then you realize that it's too big and you don't want to work on it again. Right. But with Bitsy, it's much easier to not be this kind of not fall into this kind of trap.
Yeah, and it feels maybe a little worse, a little less bad when you just say, "Well, I have to abandon it," because you're not abandoning like mountains of code that you had to come up with and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and also I know about Vine for quite a long time, but I'm not. That much of a writing person. I'm much more comfortable in expressing myself through visual images. Although I'm not a artist, but I kind of it's an easier language, a language that's more approachable to me. And so, and Bitsy is much more visual for me. Like it allows to create this sort of scenes, this images. And I don't know. I just find it very comfortable for me personally, and this is one of the main aspects why this game was made in the first place. Also, the actual reason behind it is that I am actually a member of an organization called Social Movement or Socialny Ruch. In Ukrainian, and it's a activist organization that helps workers in Ukraine and promotes socialist and anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist agenda in our society. Yeah, so I joined I was a socialist for quite some time, but I joined this like organization only a few months ago, and I thought that I should contribute to the cause in the way that I can and feel.
Art has always been a very important aspect of winning people's hearts and minds, if you will. You know, it's
yes, cause absolutely.
It's good at conveying like large, complicated, abstract ideas into ways that people can like more easily understand. Often, it conveys these huge histories, and often you can do it sometimes within a single image to kind of get people to like see the perspective you're trying to portray, especially like. And in a game, you know, it's handy to see like, oh, okay, well, if I'm playing it, it kind of forces a certain level of like active participation with the art.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been like, seeing an rise of, political, but it's kind of, again, a very loaded term, activist games, you know, games that promote certain progressive agenda and that try to educate people and to, be entertaining and also politically charged in a good way.
Yeah.
I've been... trying to make games like this from the last 5 or 4 years, but they were more sort of personal, more about my personal experiences and my my emotional states. This was very important too.
Yeah.
But this game, I decided to, you know, to try it, to make it more, like also more, almost like it's almost like a pamphlet or a, you know, agitational material that you hand to people to get them acquainted about some issue. And this was my intention, to make people know about this certain development in our country, which is not very healthy at all.
No. There is a lot of times where kind of, you know, when a focus is in one spot, that's when people can take advantage and, like, you know, when the other hand isn't looking, so to speak, and kind of, well, what if we, you know, I guess the mechanisms of profits are looking, care not for the human condition. They just see the best opportunity to be like, well, what if we made that number go up? And I see this is a great opportunity to make that number go up. And it's good. And it's good. It's like a nice thing when people, or I say a nice thing, but you know, it's a it's easy to miss perspectives on things when, like, you know.
Yes, when there's like more different and more important things happening, like war, for example.
Yeah. Right. And when, like, narratives tend to get very funneled into like the singular focus. And it's like you can forget that a country is not a monolith, and that good and bad things can happen within it. You know.
Yeah, and definitely, I was trying to be as you have to be very careful. In this specific situation, because there's a lot of narratives that sort of. Especially like in some of the corners of the left, in the West, in Ukraine, when people like take this both sides are bad approach.
You're right.
And I definitely wanted to avoid this view. I wanted to show that Ukrainian resistance is necessary and it is justified, and it requires any assistance that it can get. But also, like, we're living in a kind of very aggressive neoliberal country, and the processes in the society and in, like, legislation specifically are not very sound and should be talked about and judged, and like something should be done about it, basically,
right.
to see a thing as a complex society as it is, not just a monolith.
It's the very increasingly as people focus on you know, finding a correct answer and finding a sort of, well, this is the fictionalization of real life in some ways, where it's like, this is what this is the character of Ukraine, you know, this is how they behave, when it's like, well, no, because everyone, it's a big country. There's a lot of people in it with a lot of different, like, agendas and intentions and goals and, like, experiences and living situations and all, and so on and so forth, you know. And it's always important to be like, oh, there's a lot of different perspectives in the world, and it's like, you can't forget about, you always forget about the workers, you know.
Yeah, and you know, the irony is that I think that some of the people who are behind this legislation, they might actually honestly think that this is a good thing for the country.
Yeah.
Because I think the ideology, the intention behind it is that to make Ukraine to not scare the business away, basically to make it more comfortable for the owners of the enterprises and businesses to stay in the country. But how do you do it? By reducing like labor rights, by making it better, best, worse for the working people. And I can understand sort of this reasoning, but I definitely cannot agree with it because it's very short-term vision. It can, I think, can give some sort of boost to economy in a very short term, but in the long term, it will only create like more and more, like you know, difficult living conditions for people. People will have no incentive to stay. People will like have worse lives, and they will be much less capable of you know, defending the country and rebuilding it. So it's kind of very symptomatic for our society, unfortunately, to have this sort of, you know, short term prioritization, right? We have some boost to our profits now, but we don't care what will happen in 10 years or in 5
years.
Right.
Or like, do those profits eventually work their way around, or they just consolidate within the people who got all those profits?
Yes,
you know?
Yes, that's you know, exactly.
My state just recently passed a law about like increased taxation of people who have, you know, of millionaires, basically people who make who have a worth over $1 million.
And nice.
That was one of the arguments of like, oh, well, won't they all leave then? It's like always, won't the business people leave? It's like, they're always going to leave, but where are they going to? It's like, also, if we all, if everyone does it, where are they going to go to? They can't just keep going to somewhere else. Like, like the secret of taxation, I guess, is that someone is always going to be like, someone is always, it's like this, it's the that prisoner's dilemma where someone is always going to be like, well, we won't tax you, so you all come here and then get something, I guess.
Yes, and I think Ukraine is one of the places where they might go. You know, like if we keep doing what we're doing, because like Ukraine is obviously much cheaper than USA, and probably definitely many businesses are using labor from Ukraine. Because it's qualified enough, and it's much cheaper, so it's a no-brainer, so to speak.
Yeah, it's like when you learn about every little piece of automation, the exciting piece of technical automation is really just someone in a country getting paid like a fraction of a fraction. Like, whenever you see something, it's like, oh, look at this automated robot delivering pizzas. It's like, it's not automated. It's someone in a country very far from you being paid $1 an hour to drive your little pizza around San Francisco.
Yeah. Do you know about, I don't know if its service is still around, but there was a time when this was very popular, Amazon Mechanical Turk.
In my times of boy, do I need money? I've looked at things like that before, and it's like you do not make any money off of those.
Yeah, and like it's fascinating how blatantly like cynical it is because it's in the name. the story about the Turkish person who was inside this sort of box and it pretended like it was playing chess. Very true to our situation here in Ukraine too.
If you would like to make a penny an hour or whatever, Mechanical Turk is for you.
Yeah, actually, we had my friend. He is a programmer, and he begged like 15 years ago, it was something like this. He made a bot program that completed some of the tasks in a Mechanical Turk automatically.
Yeah.
And it was like we sort of felt like we gamed the system because we automated the mechanical torque.
Yes.
Yeah, we still made like pennies, but we were not like, you know, sitting hours doing this job. I spent all my money on buying books on Amazon, basically, because the thing was that all the money that we owed there, we could only spend on Amazon because we couldn't cash it in Ukraine.
Yeah.
So it was like, the delivery was very costly. So basically, like, buy for, I don't know, like $30, you pay $30 to deliver it. So,
yeah, doing this, I've learned all the exciting ways of transferring money around the world and how it is sometimes not that easy.
Yeah. Very, very not easy, yes.
Yeah.
Especially like from US to Ukraine. And I think, yeah, from Ukraine to US, it's easier, but from US to Ukraine, much more difficult.
Yes, yes. Yeah. There are some countries though where it is like you gotta go through a lot of hoops to find a service that you can pay someone who lives there.
Yeah,
it is. I remember coming home every day and typing in like 13 useless search entries into Bing every day so that I could one day get a Amazon gift card until they banned me from using it.
Because wow.
They said you weren't using real search terms. You were improperly using our service or something. I was like, well, I got like.
So it was like the task on the Mechanical Turk, or
it was
or
like was... No, it was like so when they wanted you to use Bing instead of like Google, it's like every search would earn you so many points.
Oh, okay. So they're promoting Bing. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, and then you would like. So, but I was like, I'm not actually going to use this thing over this period of time. So I'm going to type in L, then LL, then LLL.
Oh, I get it. So you're creating like this vision of activity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hitting my daily limit every day. And then they got mad at it.
And Internet, yeah, I don't know. It is wild place.
Yeah.
And when you get into the machinations of all these systems, it's very strange.
Yeah, I've been down a lot of roads of trying to like, well, how can you make money on the internet? And it's like you really can't. You can like all the little like surveys and etc. in the world. If you string them all together, you'll make basically nothing. For the amount of time you have to put into them.
One of the things that I wanted probably to say about how my game came about is that I worked closely with my friend, and he's also a member of this organization, Vitaly Dudin. So he is like a lawyer, and he basically provides his services to workers who are having troubles with their bosses, and their rights were violated. And basically, he's like the one who wrote some articles about. This new laws that were being taken in Ukraine, and he proposed me to make a game about the upcoming new labor law, and I thought it was very exciting to try my BC skills to make a game about this issue. Yeah, and also it was like October, and I thought it would be nice to make it to Halloween, and it was kind of also a Halloween game.
Yes. People, well, if I know anything from my time on Itch, is that people love horror games, if you can.
Yes.
And, like, and
yes.
What is a truer horror than the erosion of workers' rights?
Yeah, and that was most of my first BT horror game. So.
Yeah. That's always a very strange thing to see on, like, even the most, like, middling of horror games will have, like, 16 videos of people playing through them.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's almost, at some point, I was thinking that itch.io is, like, a... some sort of horror specific platform for horror making makers.
You would not be faulted for believing that. It is like
90%
of like what is in like the fresh category is all. It's that because it's that interesting thing because like it's a situation where I think maybe like the games themselves individually are not very relevant. It's simply the idea of. Mm-hmm. Here is a low poly game in which a scary guy tries to kill you, and that's like the entry point, and then it doesn't really matter who the scary guy is, what his point is, but it lets you, if you try, if you're clever enough, backdoor like some ideas into those games, you know.
Yeah, it also make great material for Let's Players.
So yes.
So kind of this, you know, ecology of content creation.
Yeah. It's super, super strange in that way. It's like this whole kind of ecosystem of games outside of like games. Like it's very like game adjacent even. Like, you wonder is like, Are these horror games for streamers and Let's Players more than they are for like an actual? Are they? It's that weird question. Are they meant to be even played, or are they meant to be watched? Mm.
Yeah, it's an interesting one.
Right.
I wonder. Like, I know. I definitely know that I at some point, like, I. But probably watched more games than I played games.
Yes. Yeah. I've also been thinking more about this idea of watching games like as like Let's Plays as a kind of piece of like a narrative or like a Let's Play that is more than just somebody watching a game and or playing a game with you watching them, a game, and that takes in the same way that a, like, you know, like a commentary on a movie would, where it's like a supplementary piece to the game, but it's not like a replacement for the game itself.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like on a football or a soccer field when you're watching and you're hearing the commentator, and it's also kind of form of participation.
Right.
It's kind of interesting because when I was young and I was playing like games on a console, we didn't have Nintendo, but we have like Dendy, which is a Taiwanese clone of Nintendo, if I'm correct, and it has like Super Mario Brothers and other like popular games.
Yeah.
And I was bad at platformers, but I liked watching my friends play. So I was like giving them the controller and they played much better than me. And I'm just like, you know, cheering them up.
And
it's like a movie almost. But it was a video game. So it's, was I playing a game? I don't know.
Yeah, it's this, I've never really looked at a Dendy. It's a weird little thing.
It is very weird. Very weird. Like,
yeah. I have definitely seen those cartridges before, though. I've definitely seen those Dendy cards before. That yellow is so distinct.
Yeah, and it has like an elephant as a mascot. It has like cartridges that had like 999 games on them, or at least it was like written. And I was very surprised at some point when I saw that games are actually like. Distributed one game a piece like and on a cartridge, and I was like, what?
Why? Yeah, like derivatives of those things.
Yes. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, derivatives of these things make it to the U.S. even sometimes. Like, you can find them in, like, malls. And it's like, how is someone selling these things? And, like, because you think within the U.S., you think we don't have, like, bootlegs in the same way, you know? But I definitely have, like, weird 99-in-1 carts that somebody, that a relative had bought at a mall kiosk before.
Oh, okay.
That is,
I think that it's sort of more like a curiosity in US, right? More like a, you know, like an artifact.
Right. But it's like, it is also, you know, it's at a point where if you're making this thing, like, you know, years after the original console, and you can, you know, chips are much bigger, so you can put, like, 99 games on it. It's like, hey, why wouldn't you? It is a efficient way to get a lot of games in a place where it's like, you know, otherwise they're not distributed. You know, you forget, like, the technology, not the rest of the world does not have the same release schedule as the U.S. and parts of Europe, you know. I remember someone from Brazil was talking about it. It was like, thinking of, like, well, this is kind of like what my computer can make, and it feels more technologically, like, on par. It's not, like, thought of in, like, the graphic style he was working in. He did not think of it as, like, in retro terms in the same way you might in the U.S. Just because of, like, the way technology is developed and, like, and, you know, the accessibility of consoles. Like, if you think you can't get a PS5 in the U.S., think about the accessibility of it elsewhere. You know.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
And it definitely informs, I think, these ideas of, like, design, like, game design, we're on, like, a 10-year delay.
Yeah, and it's not always, sometimes it's not that linear, you know, because, I don't know, Ukraine is more of a PC country, I think, because we had more PCs back in the 90s and in the 2000s than consoles, and the consoles have this sort of lag.
Yeah,
it's much less, you know, apparent now. But
right, especially since so much gets released on PC anyway.
Yeah, back then it was very, very pronounced, and I remember thinking, like, wow, all those games on consoles, I will probably never play them because I will never have, like, so much consoles. And you have different consoles, like, what? Like, Xbox and PlayStation.
Yeah,
don't have, I have barely money to, like, upgrade my computer. I probably just stick to it.
Right, because the computer can do other things, too. There is, like, this drive for, like, a single use, like, if we're going to make these big expensive electronic boxes, there's, like, I'm going to get the one that does more than just plays games.
Yeah, and we didn't buy our computers when we were kids.
Yeah.
It was more like, you know, more almost like an investment.
Yes.
from our parents. And while console was clearly a, you know, something of an entertainment, computer was sort of this more serious thing, it was expected that you would do other stuff on it, not only play games. which was true. They were kind of right.
Right. It's something I think people have, the other thing I try to, that I've mentioned before, and I think it's something people forget, is that, like, not everyone, like, had, like, the expectation that you would just own a computer as just, like, a natural part of your house, I think, is newer than people think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, like, even, like, I'm not that old, but we didn't have a computer until I was, like, I don't know, maybe, like, 10, 11, 12-ish, you know? It's not like I grew up, like, a computer was always in my house. And even then, it's like, it was not a powerful game-making PC, probably. and there's it, that kind of thing is like, you know, if you forget that computers are like, yeah, like you said, they're these things that are passed down. There's like, you inherit a computer because it's a big expensive box.
It's kind of interesting, and I remember it was like very controlled thing. My parents were, you know, I had they were like looking at what I'm doing. Is that I had some play hours, and I had some like I was not allowed to play at some hours, and yeah. Then I had some other stuff, and they some exercises I remember doing on computer too. So it was almost like a construction set, because computers are modifiable, and we like bought some new parts and installed them, and then it was almost like this Sheep of Theseus, that
yes.
We bought one computer, but in several years it transformed into something entirely different. Now we have like several computers that have sort of branched from this one computer, because some parts went into this and some parts went into that.
Yeah, right. It's this constant like hand-me-down process of, it's like, I got a new graphics card, but my old one, it still works. So it's like, it's wasteful to just like, you don't just throw it away. So you like, well, I'll add it to another computer. And then as I pass, yeah, exactly. As you pass down different parts and pieces, you have these different Frankenstein computers that still serve some purpose. Like maybe you can turn them into like a storage thing or some kind of Linux box for doing something. But
yeah, actually, if I remember correct, my computer or my sister's computer that I bought her is actually now my mom's computer, and she worked with it when she studied, like, she was studying web design, so she worked at my old computer. Yeah, so
now I got a lot of mileage at events out of like people's, like out of like a 15-year-old laptop that could basically, you know, it could still run the kind of games that I was making, which is the benefit of like, you know, low what's the word for low taxing engines like Bitsy, where it's like also if you can't afford a nice computer, it doesn't matter, because Bitsy will still run on your computer. It's super low intensive. It's not like you have to, like, there's that other hurdle of Unity, you forget that it's like maybe your computer can't even run Unity.
Yes, definitely. This is also one of the reasons why I like Bitsy, because I know that probably almost any person with any device, even mobile device, can play it, right? It's not as good on mobile, but you can still play it. And
I thought he was saying, I thought I saw Adam at some point talking about like making Bitsy like more mobile accessible, just even in terms of like programming.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it's so bizarre, because I've watched Adam Ledoux's presentation. He spoke at some event.
Yes.
He like talked about. Did you saw it too?
I saw that he had had a talk, but I had not watched it.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, what he talks is that he made Bitsy he had this problem. He wanted to make a game, but he had only his spare time when he was like commuting to his work on a bus. So he wanted to make an engine to make games, basically when you're on phone on bus, something like this.
Yeah.
So it's like very it was so interesting, because we found Bitsy, and we started using Bitsy specifically because we had this sort of situation when we had no. Well, my partner, she was at some point working on a train when we were like evacuating from Kharkiv. So she was making a BT game there. So it's bizarre that, you know, it was created specifically for this sort of situations. And it also create games that are accessible to people in all sort of contexts, not only on a PC.
Yeah, yeah. It, basically, if you have a device that can run the internet, it can probably play a Bitsy game.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, it also ties into the benefits of, you know, what else people can, anyone can mostly access? A pamphlet, you know? So it ties into that benefit of, like, when you need to convey ideas to a lot of people, you want to do it in a medium that a lot of people can access.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like, this is the one kind of, I don't know, a problem or some kind of aspect of video games that is not usually talked about, is that while it's a huge and massive industry, you know, and medium, still many people are much more alienated from it, especially like in Ukraine, especially people like more elderly people or like even my parents. Not in a way that, you know, today almost any person can access like cinema, right? Yeah. They can watch it in theater, they can watch it on TV, they can watch it on their mobile device or computer. And, you know, it's much more of a, it's like mass art, you know, because everybody can look at it, right? And, yeah. But games are still not there, I think, because I know, like, my parents, they know what I'm doing, but they don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, right.
They probably like played one or two of my games, and actually one of the you know indicators that I was doing something right was for me that my mother played one of my Bitsy games, and she like really enjoyed it and thanked me for it, and I thought that I'm doing something right, even a person like my mother who is very very far from video games and probably will only play them if we specifically ask her. She like tried it and she actually find it very accessible and it touched her. So
yeah, because there's games don't have the same kind of like, I mean, because like that kind of like push for technological progress and everything. It's like every 5 or 10 years, whatever, games get harder to play, or a new generation of games gets harder to play. Mm-hmm. And it's like, even if you push a movie to like 4K or, you know, you keep upping the resolutions, it's still like, there's still going to be someone who's watching it like in 360p or whatever, you know, like,
yes,
it doesn't stop the video from being played. Like, maybe you can't get the disc version, but streaming will always allow, like, even at the crunchiest, ugliest looking resolution.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's still, like, easily watchable. And there is, like...
Yeah.
It's probably why music is so mostly, what's the word I'm looking for, like, so probably, like, feels like one of the more universal mediums because it's so easily experienced.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Definitely. I agree. And one of the intentions, I mean, one of my you know, dreams is that at some point games are not as easily accessible, but, you know, much more of a common thing that every person can try and enjoy and not look at it like something like, well, I don't know this technological thing. I will never kind of... I will never try to even.
Yeah. Well, so Valeri, we are approaching our hour here. Believe it or not, this rushes by. I was like, My God, like every week this time speeds by. So I got to ask you, we have a weekly question that comes in. I think this time, did I even bother to delete it? I don't think so. The question is, it comes from Mochi, and is, do you have a favorite Toho character?
Oh, I've dreaded this question.
Okay, so you did prepare for it.
I don't know what Toho is. I'm sorry.
Then the answer is no. It's simple as that.
Yeah, but it's... I feel like I'm missing something, you know?
Yeah, it Toho. Is...
Is it a video game?
Okay, so here's my weekly explanation of trying to explain my limited experience of Toho. So my general understanding of Toho is a guy or some collection of guys created like a breakout style game, but then created a bullet hell, and it's like Toho is a bullet hell series.
Okay.
And it has a lot of little characters, and all those little characters... I think you can just sort of freely use them for whatever you want, like commercial even stuff. If you want, and I don't think there's like any kind of like licensing you have to do. I think you can just kind of do it. Maybe it changes depending on how you want to do it, or maybe there's like what's the word I'm looking for? Like use guidelines. I haven't researched it that far, but it creates this sense of like a communal ownership of this kind of. Almost, is Toho like folk? Who knows? now I'm wondering if Toho is like folk characters that that people sort of culturally share.
Wow, it's interesting.
Yeah,
so it's sort of like a franchise, but it's open to use by anybody.
Like there is like the regular people who like, you know, they make their bullet hells and all that. But then other people will make like a visual novel or a Metroidvania, and they'll, you know, they release them on Steam and everything. They're just like they are games for sale, or they'll make unofficial comics and novels and all these sorts of things around these. So you have this kind of world with a canon, but it's also like a shared world. It's interesting, I'd say.
It is interesting, yeah. It's kind of an opposite of Disney.
Yes, right, exactly. Where it's a million people funneling all these ideas into someone else's IP that they can never, then they later do not own.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, yeah, that is...
Wow.
It makes sense why Disney bought Marvel, because Marvel was doing just that. So they're like, Disney's like, I like your style. What if we bought another thing that also and didn't pay any of these people who basically created all of these characters that we base all of our legacy on, you know? I will not. That is a whole other the exploitation of like all these things that would not exist without these underpaid comic artists and writers. And now I don't think those people are seeing
game developers too.
It's just
I actually worked on a Disney game once.
Right.
So it was, I kind of
Just as long as you don't contribute any original ideas to it, then you feel less bad about it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Wow. I don't know what to feel about it.
Right.
You know, it's like such a big sort of thing. And whenever I encounter something like this, I always... I don't know what is the entry point into this, and should I even bother... to try to enter into this because it feels so so big and I don't know how to put it.
Right. No, there's giant cultural forces, and then sometimes you can just, it's like I said at the top, there is more art. If you no longer need to eat or sleep or do anything else, if you spend 24 hours of a day for the rest of your life, you would still not experience all the art humanity has to offer.
Yeah. Yes. Which is nice. Which is nice that indie apocalypse exists. You know. So it, yeah. it helps people to navigate through this strange.
Yeah.
You know, mess of ideas and experiences.
Yeah, it is an idea. I just took this from other, you know, independent curation efforts. Like, I looked at that and was like, well, there needs to be a little bit more of that in games, but also the one that costs money, because people think differently about things when they cost money.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, their perspective on them is not, is like a different perspective for, like, as opposed to just like a blog of games, a month release of something that costs money has for better or for worse, has a different effect on people, you know?
Yeah, it sort of became art retrospectively,
right.
In terms of, like, you know, a painting is not a painting until you put it into a frame and into a space where it is presented as a painting.
Yes, right.
So art in many ways is like sort of, I don't know, a label or a perspective that is applied to a work to make it more, to attract more attention to it, to make it sound more, interesting. Or,
yes.
Like, I don't know, no, that's, it feels bad.
right. Like this, like, what is art?
To put more attention to it, right?
It's kind of like, I don't know, it's a way to classify the things we make, because, I mean, is art just something that the human makes? Like, it doesn't... Okay, you know, I tried to close, and then we're getting to a broad discussion of what is the nature of
sorry.
Art. No, yeah. That is the nature of this show, is I try to, like, close it, and then I just keep talking. And sometimes I keep talking by this time, but I'm going to avoid getting into the... a denser conversation that people have been likely discussing for millennia of the concept of what is art.
Yes.
Yeah. What is simply, like, is a table art? If a human made a table, does that table a piece of art, or does it require the intent of the artist? If the carpenter says his table is art, does that make it art? And if another person says that same table they created is not art, is it simply a tool?
Yeah. It definitely will take more than an hour.
Yes, right. It's not something we have the depth to like unpack on this show. So I say, hey, just call art whatever you want to call it. Anyway, Larry, thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being in the zine. Thank you for enlightening me to another weird little connection that I did not know between developers within. That's another fun thing, is going, people like, oh, I know this person. I learned about it because I knew this person. It's like, oh, I didn't know all these people knew each other. And it's kind of like a good little.
Yeah. You're making connections.
Yes.
It's
that's
very. It's a great thing you're doing.
That's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping, like, when an issue comes out and I see that people are playing, because I follow everyone who makes a game for Indiepocalypse, and then I also, like, constantly check what they're rating, what they're adding to collections, as a way to, like, help keep on, because I'm very busy. I don't have necessarily.
Why don't people follow?
Yeah. And I don't necessarily have the time to always, like, sit, you know, sift through itch and splunk through things and find things. So it's very handy to have other people do that for me. And it's always nice to see when I always have to wonder when someone, like, plays your, like, someone played and rated your game, like, 5 stars. I'm like, did they play it because of Indiepocalypse? Did they just happen to come across it around the same time Indiepocalypse came out? I can never tell, but I like to think that even if people are not buying it, which is also the intent of the thing, that is, even if people do not buy it, that they still, like, check out the games included within. Like,
yeah,
it's meant to be, like, it's like a library, and you don't have to pay for libraries. Libraries are free.
Yeah, you can just probably download a book from internet, but libraries still exist.
Right, right. There's still like a there's something for curation and not just having everything in a giant pile.
Yeah.
The like intent behind things and not just profit driven, like let's put all of our things until we get a lot of money for them. But speaking of money and libraries and curation and finding people's stuff, where could people find your stuff if they were looking for it?
They can find me on itch.io by the name Valery Petrov, which is my real name. Or no, sorry, it's Botticelli itch.io now. But yes. I have my name, but my site, my like page has this other name, so something like this.
Perfect. And that is Botticelli is Botticelly, in case.
Yep, like a painter.
Yes. Like an artist. Yeah, I always double check. I've learned key skill of the radio. If something can be misspelled, assume it will be. And I will say you can find Indiepocalypse in. You should go to indiepocalypse.com. Hey, you should buy the thing. If you buy an issue, like, for instance, issue number 36, our fine guest here will get some money at some point in the future. It trickles in slowly, but...
You know, it's more of a token of, you know... I will probably never, use those money, but it will have a nice... nice feeling about it.
Yes. Yeah, I liked the idea. I remember hearing a podcast and I liked the idea of someone like an actor was talking about getting like $6 royalty checks from an episode of a TV show they did. And I liked that idea a lot. Like,
yeah.
A continued reminder that even though you made a thing, because art is weird because it's so much funneled into like making a thing as opposed to like regular jobs where you go in every day and you get paid for work done. Art, you typically get paid for like once or like the, you know, that first rush.
Yeah.
And then not after the fact. And I think royalties are a nice way to be like, oh yes, I did do that work and I do continue to get paid money for it. Because money, for better or for worse, is
yeah,
quite essential to living. Yeah. So
yeah, what is money but a symbolic, thing?
so the best that can be distributed around, the better. But if you want to be part of this little pocket of indie money, I said that makes it sound more lucrative than it is. You can join easily, yes. It's indiepocalypse.com/submit. If you think of other things, of course, like Patreons and newsletters, those are all the way you would think they are at indiepocalypse.com/those things. Including this very show being indiepocalypse.com/radio. It's all I know what I'm doing. You just get a URL and you auto-direct things if you don't already own your website. With that, thank you for being here. I'm going to close down the show and go, hell yeah, it is a single show, so I don't have to do any editing. Very excited about that. Goodbye.